best laid plans here. I didn't know I had to have any technology expertise today. So this topic, a shift from head to heart, a new game in the fourth quarter. I didn't quite realize what I said yesterday when John asked me to give a talk. I mean, I just thought it was going to be one of these little segments at a regular Unitarian service, not the distinguished Pollock lecture, you know. And John is so helpful, and he doesn't want to set any high standards for anybody. Like he said, imagine your Mother Teresa or Parker Palmer. What would you want to share with them? Thanks, John. So, the fourth quarter. I'll be 77, so I'm well into the fourth quarter. And I played most of the second and third quarter here in Winona. But I've welcomed this opportunity to share, and kind of the plan, I want to give a little bit of a sense of this old me and my search for truth and meaning, the emerging me, and then maybe transfer a little bit into some ways to take it into the world and what makes me hopeful, I guess. So, been a significant shift in my life since October 25th, 2017, when Mary and I met at, appropriately, at a dating site called Meet Mindful. So we're kind of mindful people in a way.
Mary, you gotta stay close to the mic. You kind of lose it when you go away.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Freeze here? So Mary was winding down this successful career as a hypnoanalyst, working a lot with childhood wounding issues. And, you know, I didn't quite get the drift of that. Kind of getting there, though, now. So perhaps the context of our partnership is somewhat set in the wording from Maria, the couples counselor that we work with at Sacred Spaces. And I'll read this from Maria. This is, Randy, your soul insists on you having a fuller experience of being embodied, being in an embodied human form, knowing yourself in your wholeness, and feeling all there is to feel in all aspects of your being. You have been an evolutionary leader for the world, and now it's time for you to lead your own evolution. Mary is the ideal partner to introduce you to, encourage you, and even insist on your showing up in your wholeness. This includes elevating your self-awareness to an almost sacred level. Her willingness and commitment to be in such a potent, challenging, vulnerable, and evolutionary partnership creates the perfect foundation for the depth and breadth of this ascension. That's a little aspirational, I would say. So, John's assignment here, remember, tell your full story about your free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Do you think it started getting at it, John? Okay, I'll continue then. So the request to visit with you came just a couple days before we went to Costa Rica in late February. And frankly, it's been constantly on my mind. I started out with a little notebook like this. I have two of them full. I have this little coding, W-U-U. And then on my phone, there's a whole note section of notes. And then there's like piles of scribbled paper. So it's been incessant. So thanks, John, for the chance. And, you know, in fact, kind of the challenge has been to pare it back. Since Tuesday, I think, I started paring it back. It was a couple hours, and I'm reminded of Karen and Pam were just in Baraboo, my hometown, and the next town to it was Sauk City, And I remember Ralph Waldo Emerson, a famous Unitarian, gave an address there for 3 hours one Sunday afternoon. Oh, yes, thanks, Margaret. 3 hours, and so I didn't know if you guys want to be here for 3 hours. Okay. So, all right. So anyhow, I've been carrying it back, but I've been kind of open to how things are showing up in my life. It's kind of a different way of thinking about truth and meaning. And one of the things, actually, on every morning we have a Zen calendar, and it has a little reading on it. And the day that I was supposed to get this promotional material sent off, I mean, I was kind of, how am I going to help you write up a little promo sheet, you know? And this was some wording from Albert Einstein. He said, "I didn't arrive at my understanding of the fundamental laws of the universe through my rational mind." So, are there other ways of knowing? So who is this Randy that you knew in Winona, I guess? And I sort of, probably my image of how I've been perceived as sort of this heady, nerdy guy. And I think kind of an early, actually that was the first slide to show you. There's this cup. And I helped Dale write a grant in the mid-80s. She gave me this cup and it just says, Randy, and then under it it says clever, and then it has all these, you know, and I kind of appreciated it at the time, but I'm kind of pulling away from that. You had a kind of a sense of this guy. And then I had another image that I wanted to share, and a wife of a guy that I was in the Army with in 1972 gave me this card of this little cherub running around. And I sort of see it as him handing out articles to people. And I think I was like, here, take this article, you've got to read it. And that was kind of me in Winona for a long, long time, I think, you know. And in that picture, actually, there's a medal, or I have the medal and it wasn't a medal from the Army, it was a medal from my high school graduation. I won two medals for leadership and scholarship. And you know, I think that set a deep sense of obligation and kind of a sense of doing good in me, but it fills me with a deep critique of what maybe I missed in education, which was sort of an emotional understanding. So Gail had another sense of me. I should have actually asked you to bring this, Gail. It's the white rabbit she gave me. You know, I'm late and carrying around with the clock, and she gave me like almost a full size one. I had that in my office for a long time, and I gave it back to her when I moved. I think it kind of reflected, and she must have sensed into this driven. I was kind of a production supervisor and thought about efficiency for a long time, you know, and I think that was part of my driving forces. And she saw that, me always on a treadmill. So what was I passionate about? Almost to obsession. And I think obsession is a good word, because I think maybe I was kind of driven by this stuff. In my, you know, what got me out of bed in the morning, which I love to get up early and just get working on those ideas, in my questing for truth, you know, and meaning and understanding. And I think that they were kind of grandiose ideas. I like to reimagine schools, and that morphed into whole community change in the Winona Council for Quality era. So my very first job after being in the Army was as a school psychologist. I came here 52 years ago to work in a dropout program called the RAP program. My first big time use of cleverness, I think, was a major federal grant that I had got at the College of St. Teresa's. It lasted actually for 6 years, from 78 to 84. And some of it was a questing for the quest for understanding is really revealed in the title of this book. It stands to reason, the rationale and implementation of a development-based, liberal arts-oriented teacher education program. So it was strong on thinking skills. Think like a scientist. Is there any other way to search for truth and meaning? Another question for understanding and searching for truth was how to make sense of how people made sense. And I think that has a real relationship to a search for truth and meaning. And what I had to put up in the photo here was the actual pamphlet that I was given in 1970, I think it was 79, at the University of Minnesota. And it had a title, it was Teaching Students to Cope with Complexity and Uncertainty. And it started with this: as we are faced with fundamental human disagreement, not merely over what to believe, but over what would count in the first place as an adequate reason to believe. So I think that's another truth and meaning statement. John's nodding his head, I guess, so that's okay. So, you know, I kind of wonder if we had taken that challenge seriously in the 70s, if we would be in this, what we call a truth challenged world today, you know. But what the pamphlet was about somebody that became a hero to me. His name was William Perry. And I would imagine he was probably, I don't know, maybe in his late 60s, even then. I guess that's not that old, actually. And he was at the Harvard Bureau of Study Council, which is kind of like a, you know, student remedial center for Harvard students. And he was very astute at noting the growth of students over years. And he chronicled kind of a stage model going from black and white thinking, hopefully, to this more complex thinking, to deal with complexity and uncertainty. And the pamphlet also describes some of the cutting-edge research that was being done at the University of Minnesota at the time, in particular by a woman that I got to know quite well and did training with her, and she spoke at St. Teresa's, and I followed up with her over the years. Her name was Lee Kneppelkamp. And she, you know, showed the kind of pedagogy used to really foster that happening. And I sometimes wonder how commonly, I know that is to pick up and bring into college classrooms, but it really offered such wonderful possibility. And so, it seems that these higher stages of dealing with complexity and ambiguity, in a way, is sort of what distinguishes Unitarians, I think. And I would posit that a lot of other faith models are dogma-based frameworks are at more literal thinking, and that's kind of what in some ways differentiates us here. So, but this has been an important area, this faith model or this cognitive development stuff, and I thought it would explain most societal changes. It's been like a millstone in a way, because it's been hard for me to convey it and for people to understand it. But I think it had a lot of ways of explaining the truth of reality. So then I started it for a year in the school district, and then came back from 83 until 92, and it was almost all behind the scenes work. I was reading and researching and writing cutting-edge grants. I had a lot of grants funded in Winona here, and I was kind of known just basically as a grant writer. But I didn't have hardly any public face, and I didn't know how to deal with conflict, nor did I ever act to it. I basically interacted with Chuck Sams, who was just the most wonderful person to work with. Some of you might remember him. That all came to a screeching halt when Chuck lost his job in some budget negotiations and stuff back in, I guess, in 92. And he asked if I wanted to stay, and we were very systematically working on things, and it just all kind of fell apart. And so the serendipity for me is that the Winona Council for Quality was taking shape. And Dan Roccavino was just an incredible visionary, and he was one of the co-founders of EMD, which became, when they sold it in 97, became Benchmark. But it was just a wonderful environment. They were one of the first organization in Minnesota to win the Minnesota Quality Award. And you could just tell the different spirit and how people felt about working there. And Dan's vision was, how does this get transferred to all sectors of the community? And that's really what the role of the Quality Council was about. And that's what I kind of did for 30 years. And I could give you a litany of all the things, but we don't have time for that. But what it just added back to the truth and meaning, what appealed to me in Deming, in a way, there was this thing called the Plan, Do, Study, Act cycle. And it was really, it's an application of the scientific method. And I thought if co-workers in companies and organizations were being taught that, it would awaken us to see that learning is really experiential and done by us in kind of forming hypotheses and testing them and learning and working with people, and in not seeing like that always the expert answer. And that, in fact, that would just almost, once everybody saw that, would say, well, shouldn't schools be doing this more? And it would revolutionize education. And, I don't think that ever quite happened the way I dreamed of it, but I always have big dreams, I guess. But what I did get about Deming somewhat is the more emotional, relational aspects of some of his work, like joy at work and driving out fear, and really touching into the psychologies that got in the way of humans working together. And I recall a workshop, actually, that EMD was putting on, and I got to go to it. And their training consultant was helping people discern if they were people persons or task persons. And where do you think I fit? Task, right? And I thought that was just who I was. And I was almost sort of dismissive of this feeling type stuff, or the heart stuff, the heart side of it. And it's just how I thought I was wired, and that sort of justified me in a way. So I've had some pretty abrupt endings in my life. My first marriage ended in divorce, and my second and third wives, some of you, Margaret, I know you remember Jean, who was a beloved education department professor at Winona State. Roger, you know her too, actually. And then Martha, who was kind of the all-around renaissance woman. They both died of rare cancers, but I just kept going. And then some of you might remember Fran, and she had been an old professional friend of mine from 25 years earlier, and we reconnected and lived together for 2 years. And I don't think we could have been more considerate or more giving, but Fran's deeper needs weren't being met. And when she left, I needed to find something that could fill my life, which is a pretty strong indictment, I think. And where did I find an answer? I thought it was going to be in Karen Armstrong's Charter for Compassion work. I was ready to kind of, I can remember the zeal I had and how I was trying to say, what can I do? How can I help with this? And how can I get involved in this cause? But I noticed in her book, The 12 Steps to Compassionate Life, there was a lot of Buddhist reference in it. And I thought, well, maybe I should learn a little bit about that. And I was going to go to California, up to the East Coast, and way here in the front row said, just go to Twin Cities Vipassana Cooperative. So I went to a 10-day silent retreat, not knowing what I was getting into at all in my search for truth, John. And I was kind of taken by that. And then the last day when we could finally talk, somebody said to me at the milk machine, "What's your practice?" I didn't even know what a practice was, but she told me about the Rochester Meditation Society. And so for 5 years, just about every Sunday, I drove to Rochester. And unfortunately, it met at the same time as the Unitarian. So 2011 sort of spelled my end of my time with you all here, except on a few rare occasions, or maybe for a potluck or something. Anyhow, you know, and I saw Buddhism as amazing insights into life and suffering and motivations. But I liked like the Four Noble Truths and impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. I mean, and not self. It's sort of like it was intellectual, and I've been working actually with a spiritual advisor. His name is Chaz de Kaparov. And he said, "Randy, your path is to your heart." And that's somewhat been an enigma to me. So, I did appreciate some of the ideas around Buddhism. I found some fellow travelers here with the city manager, Steve Sardu. I just think it's such a great loss for Winona and him not being here any longer. And then Trish and Paul Johnson from Dharma River. And Emily actually sat in on some of these meetings as we sort of imagined Winona as a city of compassion. So that was energizing and working on. And then in 2015, almost as significant, more significant maybe than that University of Minnesota pamphlet, was this book called Reinventing Organizations by Frederick Laloux. And it chronicled 12 companies from maybe a size of 100 to several thousand. And what he saw that was unique about them are three pillars. And the first one was wholeness. How does an organization support people growing to wholeness? Actually, that was Maria's charge to me in the opening reading, you know. How do you find your strengths, become aware of your weaknesses, and how do you not self-sabotage? How do organizations allow for people's self-management, to unleash people to be self-directed, responsible, and intrinsically motivated? And the third one was evolutionary purpose. And this can get pretty far out and started thinking that maybe things aren't as rigid and can be planned and controlled, how do we start trusting in sensing and responding to an ongoing full unfolding versus trying to plan and control. So that just sort of was Deming's ideas on steroids, and they were very intentional in helping people move to a higher stage of consciousness. And so I thought, and like Deming had a dream of restoring the power of the individual, and I think this just really does it so beautifully. So that was kind of all of the stuff that was just motivating and propelling this driven person, I guess. And then after October 25th, 2017, remember that day. Under Mary's encouragement, I started to take a deeper look at myself. And I started to see patterns that I had never taken this hard look. And remember, because I was this task person, and not a people person. So some of the things I learned is that I was an incredible people pleaser with very little sense of resolving conflict. I learned about attachment patterns, and I realized that mine had been kind of non-attachment, and that I had grown up in a paucity of loving emotions, actually. And that had a bearing on my intimate relationships, And could maybe explain why I never chose to be a father. I started to see myself as a lot more thin-skinned, defensive, reactive. How that fits, fancy word, Bob, you probably know this word, polyvagal theory, you know. I realized, and I also saw my drivenness. I didn't quite get into what Gail was getting at with the white rabbit, I guess. And that how I had a tendency to decide to numb myself out and not face the pain. You know, and in fact, this trip to Costa Rica, this just wasn't a frivolous vacation, you know. We went there to work with a kind of a master teacher and more deeply connecting into your body and what's to learn from that. And I have to say, I have a lot of work to do there, and I sort of got a touch there, but that's kind of a real growing edge for me. I also learned more about, or thought more about, how I dealt with anger. And I was so enamored, I actually, what was Martin Luther King really getting at when he was thinking about nonviolence, and how it relates a lot more to, and then also, how does shame fit into anger? That's been a real learning edge for me. And the final one, I guess, is how I have been very comfortable in dealing with authority. So with this ambitious title, I really haven't gotten a lot at from the shift from the head to the heart yet. And so I was kind of wondering, you know, as late as May 8th, I was still thinking, how could I even talk to you guys today? Mm-hmm. Sort of this phony guy, where is he going to come up with the heart stuff? So, but I want to share a little bit of some things that have happened. It was kind of a breakthrough in a way. So it'd be what, 2 weeks ago tomorrow, I participate in a spirituality group in our Unitarian church in Naperville. And that day there were four women and Robert and myself, two men. And we generally talk about the soul's matter. You guys know soul's matter, that it's wonderful reference and or source that comes out monthly. And the theme for March was on vulnerability, and the theme for April was on resistance. And so I was kind of ready in April to share, and then we ran out of time. And I sometimes actually prepare, type things out to share. And I was just sort of this question of, where's my heart and what's going on? And I scribbled these notes to share with people, which is uncharacteristically unprepared for me, I guess, you know, which is an interesting issue in itself. But something really clicked for me, and I wanted to share what I shared with them. So I started off by reading what I read to you from Maria, and in a sense, knowing yourself and your wholeness and feeling all there is to feel. And then I got into, and you know, it's how, when I was sharing with them, I was almost crying, and I could see they were almost crying. It really had some bearing, but I don't, what I said next is that we have this wonderful image of possibility, but how I've resisted, and I've resisted Mary's advice, and I couldn't hear her. And I've been too proud of myself, and my truth and meaning is all, you know, all in the head and ideas, and I'm impeccably honest, but I'm not with myself, perhaps. And I've avoided this hard look. So some of the resistance is also having a partner, especially one who's a therapist and has helped clients for 40 years. And it's so damaging sort of to this fragility that I had held onto it with my head and my cleverness. So I shared that, and then It's almost 4 weekends ago now. I participated in an initiatory weekend for the Mankind Project. The Mankind Project is this international effort that's been going on since 1985. There's about maybe 80,000 men around the world. And its purpose is this, for helping develop passionate, purpose-driven brotherhood, building and supporting the emotional maturity and accountable, compassionate male role models that our communities so desperately need. So they have this weekend. It's like, it was way more intense, 48 hours, not even quite 48 hours, from 5 o'clock on Friday night until about 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. Way more intense than anything I ever experienced in harassing in military boot camps and stuff like that. But what I took away from it, first of all, I got a spirit name, Intuitive Untapped Potential. That's a notch above, this rational search for truth and meaning. Then I had I pledged, as a man among men, I am vulnerable and feeling. And I had a graveside visit with my father. So I was surrounded by about 20 guys and coaches and a tombstone where I expressed to my father the hurt and the sadness, not feeling loved or listened to or nurtured, and not seeing in my family the love demonstrated and what an impact that had on my life and on my mother's and my sister's. So, that's... And then I listened to him and I had a chance to forgive him. So that was a big deal to do that. And I came home and Mary said, I came home changed from that. So I kind of got into the Mankind Project in a backwards fashion. I was supposed to do the initiation and then go into a support group. But I've been in a group via Zoom since September of 2021. And I resist going to it. I just have felt so uncomfortable. And I meet with 5 other people twice monthly. And I just had such nagging insecurities. But I had committed to being a facilitator for that Thursday night after the weekend retreat. And I got down into some really negative thinking about what a loser, how I'm just not an astute human being, how these guys are so with it and I'm such a dud, you know. And I just approached it with just such a deep, deep feeling of fear and panic. And I wanted to just bail and just say, I can't come, I can't do this, you know. And I was there, and early in the evening, we do a spiritual reading to kind of ground us. And John was going to do this reading. And lo and behold, it was on the topic of shadow. And I've intellectually known about shadow for 30 years or so. I don't know if you remember Lee Luby, and I think she was the first woman county commissioner in Winona County, right, Joanne? And she had some part in this guy Charles Bates coming to Taos Center and having this book called Pigs Eat Wolf, and it was all on shadow. And I've read it many times and never got much out of it, you know. I guess, but this. I generally read books, and when it comes to the practice sections, I would never do them. but the first shadow that John mentioned was fear. I never thought of fear being a shadow. And that got me so intrigued. I did rush off and buy the book he was reading out of, but it really clicked for me finally. And so, what I had resisted was inner child wounding. And, you know, I've actually, in addition to this being Mary's conversational topic sometimes, I have been working with a therapist on and off for 4 years around that topic, and I've avoided it too. But I finally surrendered to it. And you know, and what I'm getting out of it, and kind of a new openness that's really been freeing, and is that I'm doing more nurturing work of myself at 76. Like repeating something like this: I unconditionally love, accept, and support this little one who assumes he wasn't worthy of being loved or seen. You know, and then actually in the photos, there's a picture of me as a four-year-old that we have on our altar, and I oftentimes when we meditate, I focus in and kind of communicate and try to support, and I think there's just so much to that kind of healing, you know. So, so what's shifted for me, I guess, is kind of this sense that the more love and healing of myself goes up, the more my propensity for judging goes down. I think I've been incredibly judging of myself and of other people over my lifetime. You hear this, you know, judge not, you shall not be judged, and then I feel guilty that I've been a judger, you know, and it gets into what a sinner I am and how shameful I am. But I'm just really starting to ground in a deeper core, at a deeper core of who I am, in this, and that the more there can be a heartfelt sense of love, the more I can be non-judgmental. So some things that I resonated with, so there's something I kind of resonated, a Rumi line that I'm finally getting. And he talked about barriers to love. And Rumi said, your task is not to seek to love, but merely to find and seek all the barriers with yourself that you have built against it. So I'm beginning to see those barriers. I think that's really part of this shift from head to heart. So why has this been so hard for me? You know, here again, it's like, whew, I thought I had it figured out a week ago, and then, that Saturday, and then the following Monday, we had quite an argument. And I think, how in the hell can I be talking to you guys about this when I'm such a phony, you know, and I can't do it. And I woke up that next morning early, and I just laid in bed and sort of nurtured and soothed little Randy. And we had a beautiful conversation that morning, a resolving conversation. So I guess the thing about this is that I wasn't born again one time. This is going to be a path, and it's going to be work. But there's, you know, I think that the reactivity in a non-shaming way is somewhat going down. So that's been my search for truth and meaning on the outside. And, you know, John mentioned Parker Palmer. I did have to go look up Parker Palmer. I know from his times, many visits in Winona. I don't know if you realize his wife was a Winonan, actually. And he was talking about the inner teacher, and I don't think that's that different from the untapped intuitive potential that surfaced in the Mankind Weekend. And so I was recounting, and Mary was sharing, mentioning my progress in the 6 weeks since we had seen Maria at Sacred Spaces, last Saturday, actually. We could go Saturday. And I was stressing, you know, movement to non-judgment and self-acceptance, and that I felt I could ride that a long time. And she said, it's a bridge to take me deeper into an understanding of the facets of a complex person. And it's funny, I don't think I've ever seen any complexity about me. I just think I've been this idea devouring data machine, artificial intelligence or something. Without any harder look of really knowing myself and having such a limited view of my loving potential. It's hard to see the sacred in another when you don't see, when you only see yourself as a processing machine, I think is a thought I had here. So I'm taking this new heartfelt way, and part of the new game in this fourth quarter is that. So my search for truth and meaning has turned inward, and the heart is playing a way bigger role. So it's humbling. I've held myself in high regard, I think. In some ways, I'm one of the good guys, I guess. But there's this paradox. There's been this inner nagging that has me limited in many ways, most notably in inner peace. I haven't been aware of this anxiety that so gripped me most of my life. There's a lack of trusting. When's the next shoe going to drop? Isn't it just a normal way of living? Don't we all live that way? And it's funny, even though I've spent a lot of time with Keegan's Immunities to Change on anxiety management, I was reading it for others' help, not for my own. So part of my new freedom is from the anxieties of this anxious child and how that's opened me to be a much more tender and loving person. So I've been sharing here, and I know we're getting kind of close to time, but I wanted to share just a little bit on taking this into the outer world. And if I could have some do-overs, I wish I had connected to my heart and modeled this inner journey more at a, you know, in the second and third quarters maybe. And because I think masses of us doing this inner healing together is a partial antidote to this scary, dehumanizing world today. So, to the outer world, we have a wonderful photo of our dynamic, visionary, and quite beautiful 40-year-old new minister in our church, and she is, we've been in an interim minister status for 3 years, you know, so it's just wonderful since August she's been with us. And her name is Mandy Huizenga, and she preaches about and leads about woundedness, love, beloved community, and seeing systems of domination and oppression. She talks of intersectionality, which is a big word that's a talk in itself. So we just think there's such a opportunity in our church, and it's kind of what we are stepping boldly forth and proposing a class. We don't know what form it'll be in yet. That will, and the title is Join Us to Consider the Possibility of Imagining Our UU Tradition from a Unique Inner and Outer Perspective, Starting with the Body. I have a whole description of that, but we'll move on from that. But so I wanted to say this, in my old reactive, in my old ways, I'd seen truth as some kind of moral rectitude. In my new lens, I'm seeing truth challenged by a lack of courage driven by unworthiness. So, truth is challenged by a lack of courage driven by unworthiness. I've seen that in myself. And another book that Wade put me onto a while back that I didn't get, Perfect Love, Imperfect Relationships by John Wellwood, is just meaning so much more to me today. He was a psychologist and a Buddhist teacher. I just want to close with some of, or say some of these quotes from this book. There is no weapon for the realization of truth that is more powerful than this, to accept yourself. So at that core of self-acceptance. Another quote here, you will never feel loved until you love yourself. Another, indeed there would be no hatred of others without hatred of self. Self-hatred is the hidden underbelly of all violence and nastiness in the world. In our culture, self-hatred is epidemic, infecting almost everybody to some degree. Even those who manage to conceal it under a veneer of success or looking good. I think that could have somewhat described me living here. Behind all the evils of the world is the pain of a wounded, disconnected heart. We behave badly because we hurt inside. There are no bad people, only badly loved people. So I wanted to just I'll give credit to Wade for one other book here that I want to share quick. This is all Wade's fault, actually. So, and this is from an extender of Marshall Rosenberg from Nonviolent Communications work. She's a Swede by the name of Liv Larson, and her book was Anger, Guilt, Shame, Reclaiming Power and Choice. And I just think these are some really big ideas. About 8,000 years ago, large parts of humanity turned from seeing themselves as part of the universe to position themselves at the center of the universe. And that's really, you know, when formal agriculture and structures started happening. We embraced a hierarchical way of seeing the world, and those in power supported this notion of our true nature being sinful, evil, and selfish. And we needed someone to control us in order to guarantee that no one would be harmed. From this limited horizon, it gives us the ability to quickly divide people into normal and abnormal, good or evil, to have opinions of how things should be. Rosenberg says we have lived a long time in this destructive mythology. All of this is just a story that we started to believe about ourselves that comes complete with the language that dehumanizes people and turns them into objects. A few weeks ago at our church, we heard a sermon on the I-it versus the I-thou relationship. This is how that's happened. And, you know, this is the sickness in our society. You know, and I think, in a way, why I somewhat believe in these healthy organizations is they're trying to get us out of those beliefs that we're such sinful people. And when you think about it, most religion in the last 8,000 years, or most Abrahamic religions, really have a strong judging God. How does that relate to all these images of self, you know? And so I think there's just a lot to think about there. And out of this reinventing organizations, I encourage you sometime to just Google Enlivening Edge. It's an electronic journal that's chronicling since Lulu's book came out. There's probably 1,200 entries from around the world of organizations that are living out this deeper dream of tapping into human potential. So that's something that really gives me a lot of hope. And I remember making, but probably the last time I shared something here was in 2010, and I had the Enneagram chart. And I don't think I had even made these leaps at the time, but there's one particular and it's maybe hard to, it is hard to convey this, I guess, but there's a concept of holy truth. Holy truth. Holy cow. All is one. Everything is part of one unfathomable reality that collectively is true, and it's non-conceptual. We feel this in our very selves. And when we do, all alienation, fear, and desire ends. This knowledge is liberation, and a profound inner peace comes. What begins to manifest in us is being fully and deeply human and responsive, completely sincere, direct, heartfelt, unself-conscious, as we feel profound communion with the natural world. We awaken to a largeness of heart that allows us to feel compassionate, benevolent towards self, the others, and the world. There's a gentleness, a forbearance, and a mercy. I just think these are such beautiful images, and I think that moving from head to heart really allows, and what I would say, what this is really getting at, is calling us back to that second tier of consciousness. Maybe it's interesting that Unitarians, unity, calling us back to unity and to feel that, not to think it, but to feel it, and that really gets back to the how do you feel that in your body? Has to be, I don't know, plug for body work, Debbie. I don't know. So, this kind of got a little disconnected at the end here. Maybe if I'd have got disconnected at the beginning, I would say, actually, Mary and I are going to be delegates from our church to the General, the Unitarian General Assembly in Pittsburgh. And you know, I don't know if you're aware that there's talk about redoing the seven principles, you know, to that diagram. I was going to show that diagram that has love at the center, but perhaps. And I know in some of our church discussions, well, this just sort of sounds like going back to the 60s or bringing the Beatles in to be our theologians or something. But I think there's perhaps a lot more to what love is about, that this doing this talk and all the pondering and preparation, I was even writing notes this morning, actually. So I just have... I want to just finish with one reading that Mary and I do not read. We have this memorized at the end of our meditation in the morning. That somewhat ties into this different stage of living in the heart. It's caught in a self-centered dream, only suffering. Holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher, being just this moment, compassion's way. So, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity. This has really meant a lot. I've learned a lot since the assignment, Professor Collins.
We look forward to a check from you.
So, and, you know, it seems like to play from my heart and realize what true freedom is is a big deal for me in the fourth quarter. So thanks for listening, and holy smokes, it's 11:05.